Voice of America.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ebola crisis. Pro-democracy protests continuing in Hong Kong. U.S. and Afghanistan signing a 10-year security pact plus a security lapse at the White House. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. medical authorities have diagnosed the country's first case of the deadly Ebola virus. The patient is a man who became infected in Liberia and traveled to the U.S. state of Texas. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Tom Frieden, spoke with reporters late Tuesday.
This individual left Liberia on the 19th of September, arrived in the U.S. on the 20th of September, had no symptoms when departing Liberia or entering this country, but 4 or 5 days later, around the 24th of September, began to develop symptoms. On the 26th of September, initially sought care, and Sunday, the 28th of September, was admitted to a hospital in Texas and placed on isolation. We received in our laboratory today specimens from the individual, tested them, and they tested positive for Ebola. The state of Texas also operates a laboratory that found the same results. The testing for Ebola is highly accurate. It's a PCR test of blood. So what does this mean? The next steps are basically threefold. First, to care for the patient, and we'll be hearing from the hospital shortly, to provide the most effective care possible, as safely as possible, to keep to an absolute minimum the likelihood, the possibility that anyone would become infected. And second, to maximize the chances that the patient might recover. Second, we identify all people who may have had contact with the patient while he could have been infectious. And remember, Ebola does not spread from someone who's not infectious. It does not spread from someone who doesn't have fever and other symptoms. So it's only someone who's sick with Ebola who can spread the disease. Once those contacts are all identified, they are all monitored for 21 days after exposure to see if they develop fever. If they develop fever, then those same criteria are used to isolate them and make sure that they are cared for as well as possible so that they maximize their chances and to minimize or eliminate the chance that they would infect other people. The bottom line here is that I have no doubt that we will control this importation or this case of Ebola so that it does not spread widely in this country. It is certainly possible that someone who had contact with this individual, a family member or other individual, could develop Ebola in the coming weeks. But there is no doubt in my mind that we will stop it here.
That is Dr. Tom Frieden. He is director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. UN Children's Fund reports thousands of Ebola orphans in West Africa face stigma and rejection from their families as well as the community for fear of being infected. As a consequence, UNICEF says many of these orphans are abandoned and must fend for themselves. Lisa Schlein reports from the UN in Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says at least 3,700 children in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have lost one or both parents to Ebola since the outbreak began late in 2013. UNICEF Regional Director for West and Central Africa, Manuel Fontaine, says this number is probably just the tip of the iceberg, and the number of children orphaned by Ebola is likely to double by mid-October. The UNICEF official has just returned from a two-week visit to the three Ebola-affected countries. Speaking on a line from Dakar, Senegal, he says children usually go to Ebola treatment centers with parents who have become ill. If their parents die, he says the children are left alone. He adds that finding someone to care for them is a problem.
The issue still remains very much stigma.
For example, we've had a case recently of a young four-year-old boy who was in this situation. We had found a survivor to take care of the child, and this is the community that rejected the child. So it is extremely difficult. Increasing number of children are left on their own in their homes because there was an Ebola case. They are usually being fed by neighbors, but no more than that, and not cared for.
Fontaine says UNICEF is looking for alternative ways of getting care for these orphan children. One is to have Ebola survivors take care of these children, at least during the 21 incubation period. After that, he says, other long-term solutions will have to be found. He tells VOA the Ministry of Social Welfare in Sierra Leone and UNICEF are organizing a conference of survivors in that country in mid-October to see what role they could play in caring for these abandoned children.
Survivors at the moment are trying to get together in some form of a network, which is very positive. They're really trying, I think, partly because they need to try to help each other. Survivors also suffer from stigma, although they are immune, but there is still this issue of stigma, and when they go back to their communities, they're usually poorly welcomed. So they're trying to gather in some form of a network, and this is what we're going to try to build on, basically. It is Sierra Leone for the time being, but we will obviously need to do the same thing for the two other countries.
Over the next 6 months, Fontaine says UNICEF will train more than 2,500 Ebola survivors in Sierra Leone to provide care and support to quarantined children in treatment centers. He says efforts also are being made to reunite separated children with their families. The agency runs programs in the two other Ebola-affected countries as well. In Liberia, UNICEF is helping the government train 400 additional mental health and social workers and is helping to strengthen family and community support to children. In Guinea, UNICEF and its partners plan to offer psychological counseling to about 60,000 vulnerable children and families in Ebola-affected communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Official Hong Kong marked the 65th anniversary today of the founding of Communist China. City leaders remain locked in a tense standoff with tens of thousands of protesters demanding greater democratic reforms. As the city bristled with tension, an early morning flag-raising ceremony drew marching bands and hundreds of dignitaries there commemorating China's National Day. Nearby, the pro-democracy demonstrators, angered by pro-Beijing government restrictions on 2017 elections, showed no signs of backing down. And late Tuesday, VOA's Brian Patton caught up with a couple of the demonstrators who have been on the streets each day of the protests.
They are using some violence action to react to our citizens and all our university students. We got no weapons, and we are not going to fight with them. We just want to peacefully express our feeling, and that's all.
Aren't you afraid it's dangerous tonight?
Not really.
Why?
There's so many people here. So why do I have to be afraid? Yeah. There are so many people. We face the same danger. So they are still here. They're not afraid. Why I have to be afraid?
Hong Kong's chief executive is calling for an immediate end to the pro-democracy protest, even as activists threaten to expand their campaign of civil disobedience. In a speech on Tuesday, Leung Chun-ying said he would not give in to the protesters' demands for his resignation or for greater democratic reforms. Instead, the embattled chief executive called on the Occupy Central movement to end the five-day-old protests because they have, as he described, gotten out of control. Occupy Central had set a deadline for today for Leung to meet their demands. If he did not, the group said it would announce its next stage of civil disobedience. And as to whether the events in Hong Kong have been an embarrassment to the Beijing leadership, who had hoped to avoid any similarities in Hong Kong to what happened during the Arab Spring uprising, VOA sought some insight from Martin Flaherty, co-director of the Leitner Center for International Law at Fordham University.
Oh, yes, I think it's extremely embarrassing to them. And there's several ironies here, not least of which is part of the general hardening and crackdown under President Xi Jinping's regime in the last 2 years has been, among other things, to expel Western journalists from China, and many of them are now in Hong Kong, where they are now covering what is going on. But as you say, from the bottom up, the fact that in Hong Kong, because there is the emphasis on two systems and there is a guarantee of freedom of speech and association, there is Twitter, there is Facebook, there are all sorts of media platforms that are banned behind the Great Firewall of China, but are used and used robustly within Hong Kong, and you can see the results in these demonstrations.
That is Martin Flaherty, co-director of the Leitner Center for International Law at Fordham University. The United States is welcoming the signing of a delayed bilateral security agreement with Afghanistan as an important step in strengthening the strategic partnership between the two countries. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the signing of the agreement comes just 3 months before U.S. and NATO forces officially end combat operations brought on by the September 2001 terrorist attacks against the United States.
John Podesta, a senior advisor to President Obama, welcomed the agreement, which is expected to keep a smaller U.S.-NATO force in Afghanistan beyond the December 31st end of the International Security Assistance Force combat mission after 13 years.
The bilateral security agreement provides the legal framework for the United States to continue to train, advise, and assist Afghan national security forces so terrorists can never use Afghanistan to launch attacks against the U.S. or its allies. The continuation of our security partnership will help Afghanistan preserve its progress in education, healthcare, human rights, and economic opportunity.
Talks on the security agreement began in November 2012, and the stated goal was agreement by May of 2013. But negotiations with former President Hamid Karzai proved difficult, and he refused to sign it, preferring his successor do so. Afghanistan's contentious election process further delayed the signing. RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Arturo Munoz says one of the difficult issues was the role the force would have in future combat operations.
People were adamant for years that it would not have a combat role, that their main mission would be to support the Afghan army, the Afghan armed forces, and provide them with additional training, with advice. One big unresolved question was that this stay-behind force would include a commando element that would continue to do raids against suspected terrorists. For the Afghans, this was a hot-button issue. Foreign troops breaking down the doors of Afghan homes at night to do raids against suspected terrorists. The accusation was that a lot of times the intelligence wasn't good and they broke into the wrong house.
Munoz says the solution is to embed the U.S. NATO forces with Afghan security forces who would take the lead in any such operation. A similar status of forces agreement is expected to be signed by the new government with NATO, leaving an as yet undetermined residual force in the country after the new year. The Obama administration says the reduced force will have as its twin objectives training Afghan forces and counterterrorism operations against al-Qaeda. Administration officials say the U.S. presence will be reduced by about half at the end of 2015 by consolidating troops in Kabul and at Bagram Airfield. By the end of 2016, the military will draw down to a normal embassy presence in Kabul, providing equipment and advice. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki was asked Monday if the U.S. force, expected to number about 9,800 after 2014, will be able to successfully help Afghan security forces neutralize the Taliban.
There's a training component of this that has been ongoing, and as you know, Afghans have been in the lead, and we are continuing to implement that in the months ahead. We are felt committed and felt so strongly about moving forward, of course, with the conclusion of this political situation as well as the signing of a BSA so we can continue to have that partnership. Obviously, it has to be implemented and we need to continue to work closely together to achieve a successful outcome.
Munoz says the importance of the continued presence of NATO and U.S. troops goes beyond just their military role.
Not only in terms of the military advice and training, which is their main function, But the fact that they're there also gives assurance to all the Western donors that are contributing money to the Afghan government that there's going to be stability and that Afghanistan is not going to adopt an anti-Western position, kind of like Iraq did.
Another RAND Corporation South Asia analyst, Jonah Blank, says the U.S. NATO force is crucial as the fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban remains intense.
The fact that the U.S. and other partner nations will be present doesn't suggest that this is going to be an easy fight. This year, the Taliban killed more Afghan soldiers and police than it has in any year since it fell from power. And there are no signs that it is easing up.
Blank says the real test for the U.S. NATO force left behind is whether it can succeed in helping Afghan security forces keep Afghanistan from becoming an ungoverned space again and returning to what he calls the bad days of the 1990s when the Taliban took control. They were, he says, bad not just for the international community, but for the Afghan people. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
After a series of attacks by pro-Moscow militia, Ukraine's prime minister has accused Russia of failing to honor the ceasefire agreement signed on September 5th. At least 9 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed in just the last 2 days. Henry Ridgewell reports from near the front line in eastern Ukraine.
Putting new equipment to the test, soldiers from Ukraine's National Guard opened fire on a test model of a new armored vehicle Tuesday at an army base outside Kiev. Commanders hope it will give them more protection on patrol during anti-separatist operations in eastern Ukraine. Watching the demonstration was Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. He accused Russia of failing to honor the ceasefire deal signed in Minsk in September. A ceasefire is when nobody is attacking and nobody is dying, he said, adding that Russia signed 12 points on the Minsk memorandum and should fulfill every point of it. Words and deeds are far too apart in Russia, he said. Pro-Moscow rebels launched an offensive against government forces at Donetsk Airport Monday, a key battleground in recent weeks. The Kremlin denies it's giving the rebels military support. One condition of the ceasefire is being met, the exchange of prisoners held by both sides. But Kiev accuses the separatists of stretching the peace deal to breaking point. Colonel Andrei Lysenko is spokesman for Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council. Lysenko said that over 1,000 hostages have been released during the ceasefire, adding that they are seeing more shootings and more attacks by separatists and pro-Russian rebels. In a provocative move, residents tore down a statue of former Soviet leader Vladimir Lenin in the eastern city of Kharkiv Sunday. Pro-Russians in the city had defended the statue earlier this year when several others were being destroyed across Ukraine. Leonid Onichenko was among the crowd cheering the demolition. It was an insult having the statue here, he said. We are an independent country and we have a monument to the former leader of the neighboring state, which attacked us at least 3 times in the last century and now in this century. A column of tanks and armored vehicles, free of insignia, except for the flag of the separatist self-styled Donetsk People's Republic, was seen traveling through Makiivka on the outskirts of Donetsk Monday. Kiev says only Russia could be supplying such military hardware. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Eastern Ukraine.
Here in Washington on Tuesday, U.S. Secret Service Director Julia Pearson came under sharp criticism from members of Congress who pressed her to explain how an intruder was able to evade security, enter the main floor of the White House 10 days ago. Republican and Democratic lawmakers expressed concern about the safety of President Obama and his family. VOA's Cindy Sain reporting from Capitol Hill.
Democrats and Republicans on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee often argue bitterly with each other. But on Tuesday, they turned their anger and frustration on Secret Service Director Pearson. Republican Representative Jason Chaffetz was outraged that Pearson praised what she said was the tremendous restraint Secret Service agents showed after the incident on September 19th, when a man with a knife was able to run all the way into the East Room of the presidential mansion before he was apprehended.
Tremendous restraint is not the goal and the objective. It sends a very mixed message. The message should be overwhelming force.
Secret Service Director Pearson promised a comprehensive investigation into the failures that allowed the intruder to jump a fence, cross the grounds, and enter the White House, and said she would take action if needed.
It's clear that our security plan was not properly executed. This is unacceptable, and I take full responsibility, and I will make sure that it does not happen again.
Her response was not good enough for many of the lawmakers on the panel, including Democrat Stephen Lynch.
And I wish to God you protected the White House like you're protecting your reputation here today. I wish you spent that time and that effort to protect the American president.
Lynch said he has serious questions about Pearson's leadership and that he fears for the safety of the president and the first family within the confines of the White House. Washington, D.C. delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton pointed out that as the first African-American U.S. president, Mr. Obama faces even more danger.
According to threat assessments, this president has had three times as many threats as his predecessors.
Pearson was also asked about another incident in 2011 when a man fired into the White House and it took several days for the Secret Service to realize that the building had been hit. Several lawmakers blame Pearson for sending mixed signals about whether agents could use lethal force if they felt the president is in danger. Some said the height of the White House fence is not the problem, but that several layers of security failed to stop the fence jumper until he had crossed the lawn, opened the door, and run through the main floor of the White House. President Obama and his daughters had left the building just minutes before the intruder came in. Cindy Sain, VOA News on Capitol Hill.
And you can get more on this story and the rest of the day's news at our website, voanews.com. Some of that news includes these stories. U.S. authorities have charged four members of a computer hacking ring, and the theft of secret data is the crime they're accused of, used in American products, including Xbox games and training software for military helicopter pilots. The four young men, ranging in age from 18 to 28, were indicted on charges including conspiracy to commit computer fraud, copyright infringement, identity theft, and wire fraud. The total value of the data they stole, plus the cost associated with the theft, is estimated at $100 to $200 million. Well, it will not arrive until late next year, but now we know the name of the new version of Microsoft's Windows operating system. It will be Windows 10. At the official presentation on Tuesday in San Francisco, company officials said Windows 10 will be especially geared toward businesses with its enhanced security and management capabilities. And starting later today, Microsoft plans to open an opportunity for its more enthusiastic supporters and users to further influence how the new operating system will look before it's released to the public in 2015. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. If you'd like to have a podcast of this program, in fact, many of the VOA programs, all you have to do is go to voanews.com and look under the Programs tab for your particular program, including International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On October 1st, 331 BC, Alexander the Great defeated Darius III of Persia in the Battle of Gaugamela in modern-day Iran. The victory led to the end of the Persian Empire. On this day in 1946, following the Second World War, the International War Crimes Tribunal in Nuremberg, Germany, sentenced 12 high-ranking Nazis to death for crimes against humanity. Among the condemned was Hitler's second-in-command, Hermann Göring. The decision by Great Britain, Russia, France, and the United States to hold the trials proved influential in the development of international criminal law and the Permanent War Crimes Tribunal. On this day in 1936, during the Spanish Civil War, General Francisco Franco was named head of the rebel nationalists. It would take him more than 2 years to defeat the Republican loyalists. Following his victory, Franco served as Spain's fascist ruler for 40 years. Today is National Day in China. The PRC was founded on October 1st, 1949. On this day in 1965, the Indonesian Army, led by Chief of Staff General Suharto, crushed a suspected communist coup by fellow military leaders against Indonesian President Sukarno. Suharto's ploy led to political disarray and allowed him to wrest power from Sukarno the following year. The coup attempt led to a mass anti-communist purge in which hundreds of thousands of people were killed. On this day in 1971, the Walt Disney Company opened the Magic Kingdom theme park in Orlando, Florida. Today, the park is part of the larger Walt Disney World, one of the most popular amusement parks in the world. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama has emphasized that the confrontation with terror organizations such as ISIL must be seen for what it is, a fight between murderous extremists and the world. On September 24th, the United Nations Security Council acknowledged the validity of that emphasis when it unanimously adopted Resolution 2178, drafted by the United States. The resolution imposes new obligations on states to prevent foreign terrorist fighters from crossing their borders and to have laws criminalizing such fighters and those who support and finance them. The perpetration, planning, or preparation of or participation in terrorist acts, or the providing or receiving of terrorist training are also defined as criminal. In addition, the resolution urges member states to strengthen cooperation with one another and calls on all, while confronting the problem of foreign terrorist fighters, to respect human rights and fundamental freedoms. It also underscores the centrality of countering violent extremism to prevent and respond to radicalization to violence. As an indication of the global consensus on foreign terrorist fighters, Resolution 2178 had 104 co-sponsors. It was adopted under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which means it is binding. The resolution targets all foreign terrorist fighters traveling anywhere in the world, but its drafting and adoption have been spurred by the brutality of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, otherwise known as ISIL. President Obama presided over the Security Council meeting, only the sixth time in 70 years that such a meeting occurred at the head of state level, demonstrating the urgency of the threat posed by terrorists crossing borders and unleashing unspeakable violence. President Obama called the approval of the resolution historic. He stressed, however, that words spoken here today must be matched and translated into concrete action within nations and between them, not just in the days ahead, but for years to come. Noting that this challenge cannot be met by one nation alone, he pledged that all committed to this urgent work will find a strong and steady partner in the United States of America.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.